This is a reading from Richard Rose's Albigen Papers, the fifth paper, Obstacles to Transcendental Efforts, Ourself as an Obstacle. Most obstacles that inhibit the research or search for truth find their roots in the discrepancies in our evaluations described in previous writings. The greatest difficulty for man lies in his imperfect vision. We need to see things more clearly. The philosophy of the past has been beset with confusion by taking a positive approach to this business. It is impossible to state our aim beforehand. It is foolish to assess the utility value of religion or philosophy. We are dealing with the essence of things, not their effects. By their fruits you shall know them does not belong here, regardless of its piety as a quotation. We are not interested in greasing the axle of the wheel of nature with utilitarian platitudes. We must not tremble that our search and our discoveries cause unhappy ripples in another man's religion or in the fashionable thinking of any particular era. We are busy with too many obstacles to bargain with anyone or to gamble away verities or the possibility of arriving at verities out of tender solicitude for venal and transient religion or mores. The first obstacle is ourselves. We are limited. Our limitation is demonstrated not by our cosmic insignificance alone, but by our mental uncertainties, by the extremely qualified aspects of human comprehension, and by the emotional apparatus with its inclination to wear the respectable mask of intuition. We are inclined to seek out that which makes us happy, and as a result, some of the happy boys with scholastic knighthood and title get things mixed up with their own adolescent unhappiness and decide that happiness is the goal, the God, and the way. Momentarily, because they have studied about aberration, they imagine that knowledge of the disease of rationalization makes them immune to rationalization. We must be aware of the influence of our desires have in motivating for us our choices of religion or life's work. We must put some time into observing our limitations and determining, if possible, ways to allow for the percentages of error caused by these limitations. Now, this sounds like a bit of formulation, but it is not. The business of such observation is not to be evaluated quantitatively. It means that a man groping in the dark must learn to protect himself not only from uncertainty but from his own reactions to the gropings. Physically, man imagines himself to be the supreme animal, but his sensory efficiency is often inferior to lesser animals. He cannot smell as well as most animals. The dog seems to be able to hear sounds that the human misses. At least the dog reacts to such sounds. Let us take into consideration the powers of lesser animals and contemplate our status if we had them. In rooms where poltergeist phenomena or spirit-like manifestations occur, dogs have shown by their attitude and bristling hair that the manifestation to them was something real. These dogs, incidentally, had not been previously brainwashed by books or theories. Their reactions were spontaneous. Perhaps if we could see with their eyes, we could evolve better spiritual concepts. It has been demonstrated that many animals have telepathy. Stranger still is the homing instinct of pigeons and the habits of birds and animals that are generally labeled instinctive. These abilities are fairly accurate mechanisms similar to radar. Some of these talents are most noticeable in fish. The animal also has a direct and quick understanding with other animals. The herbivorous animal knows the propitious moment for eating and for running at the approach of the predator. Specialization of our skill has lost these abilities for humans. On the other hand, our senses are often deceiving, besides being weak and inadequate. Vibrations and rays must surely have a wide range of meaning for different animals because of diverse sensory apparatus in different species, which means that the human appreciation of what he sees and hears is not by any certainty a real understanding of the projection or projector. We do not know if having animal intuition would help us in any great way, but we can lose a little bit of our stuffiness if we observe the animal. We may sit in a church or a lecture hall for 20 years listening to the same preacher and never know the most elementary thing which we need to know, namely, the veracity of the speaker, whether or not he is a liar. The 20 years would be spent in evaluating, arguing, and weighing one elusive sermon against another when it may have been possible to have gone directly to the mind of the man. I did not mention that the man may have been misguided. However, if we cannot determine if that man is a liar or not, what other evaluation has any validity? But let us look at word evaluation. This is necessary because we might spend our 20 years taking correspondence courses in salvation, or we may be obsessed with fundamentalism or the intrinsic value of some manuscript. Words are like refractions and bear to the perception or perceptee a variation of refraction in proportion to the position and capacity and to the conductivity of the environment which stands between the meaning to be projected and the perceptee. When the idea of this language barrier comes into view, I immediately think of the Tower of Babel. I find it easier to believe that this story is an allegory of early theological frustrations brought on by language barriers of the era, rather than an account of a petty god dispersing his supplicants. Christ advised us to seek, but the Old Testament excreates the seeker and almost infers that God was alarmed at the height of the Tower of Babel. Since there has been no celestial reaction to the sending of rockets to the moon, we must reappraise the significance of God's anger at a pile of rocks. There is another explanation to the story of the Tower of Babel. It may be that the early Hebrews, or inhabitants of that religion, were being directed by an entity that posed as a deity, which or who, being desirous of maintaining its powers over the tribe, resorted to noisy manifestations to keep the people in line. Thus we have a hint that the Lord of the Old Testament was human, which would account for the descriptions of personal appearances, instructions given vocally and heard by the multitudes, besides other phenomena attributed to God. The physical body also places limitations upon the mind of man. William James makes quite an issue out of this aspect of man. He calls medical materialism that school of thought that looks into the human body for disturbances that limit the mind and religion of each man. He infers that it might be possible to diagnose a man's physical diseases by listening to his philosophic or religious protestation. Medical materialism may well have a point, but we, in turn, may diagnose it as emanating from minds diseased by egotism and laziness. While it is true that a person's religious zeal may suddenly increase with old age, it is also true that we can find many religious zealots in healthy individuals under 20. We cannot trace the zeal of man to a disease unless we admit that disease to be common to all protoplasm, if we wish to call it a disease. Such diseases would be curiosity and any inability to overcome the obstacles listed in this book. The amoeba manifests curiosity. Curiosity is found in all forms of life where any degree of individual consciousness is found. If we presume ourselves to be of divine origin, then curiosity is a divine mandate. If we are considered to be evolutionary products of lesser beings of accidental origin, then that curiosity is as normal as any animal function and is of tantamount importance to any animal's survival. And a goat need not have a diseased liver or mind to have the compulsion to climb to the top of a barn roof for just a look around. The medical materialist fails to take into consideration the ramifications of curiosity, and he implies that a man is sick if he is neither eating, working, or being happy according to the restricted pleasure code of society. Still, we must not miss a good point. There are people who are quite a bit off base, and some of them gravitate toward transcendentalism. Yet, I still cannot see a clear line drawn that would make all seekers out to be sick any more than to presume that all sick people are transcendentalists. Not long ago, a seemingly healthy ex-Marine shot and killed about a dozen people from the tower of a Texas university. Despite his previously normal behavior, a post-mortem examination showed that he suffered from a brain tumor or lesion. On the other side of the fence, I knew a man who lived outside of San Antonio who was respected as a psychic healer. He was just an ordinary fellow until a kick by a horse caused a brain tumor. The accident happened when the man was young, but he lived beyond the 60-year mark before the tumor killed him. He ascribed his healing ability to the kick in the head. If we are to judge him from a functional viewpoint, this second man helped thousands of people and had visions as a result of mind or brain impairment. He was not irrational, unless we wish to define the whole healing system as being irrational. He maintained that diseases were caused by demons or entities, and he had the ability to banish the entities. It was that simple, and it evidently worked to the satisfaction of thousands. We find that some sects candidly admit that a spiritual breakthrough is often coincidental to a mental breakdown or follows on the heels of somatic suffering or disaster. In the history of the Zen masters, we find that one fellow applied to the monastery and was rejected. He tried to pry his way into the gate. The attendant slammed the gate and cut off his legs, whereupon he received enlightenment, end quote. Evidently. Our smile may not be justified. I have been acquainted with quite a number of people who were striving for Satori. Some of them were taken right to the door of death by some cause, and after operations or a damaging siege of illness, they came out with the claim they had reached the state beyond concern. One man had colitis that nearly killed him, and I presumed at the time that his stay in the hospital was for a colostomy. I think I have mentioned elsewhere in a previous writing the case of the woman student of Zen who attempted suicide. There may have been such attempts that were successful. However, all movements have their share of suicides. There is no prophetic pattern, and Zen does not require colitis, ulcers, or amputations. The sedentary life of a clergyman is liable to produce an occupational peculiarity or ailment. A trend toward effeminacy may be a corollary of clerical occupations. Even as a coal miner may develop silicosis, so a priest, whether he preaches asceticism or Pollyanna, may come up with ulcers, thyroid trouble, or prostatitis. It does not follow that all priests become priests because they had prostatitis. There are hazards to each profession. The metaphysician has his share, and I do not intend to brush aside either the motives for becoming a seeker or the illnesses that result from the work as a seeker. We can be too careful of being guilty of some complex or other and inhibit our drive down to zero. On the other hand, we must be able to recognize the signposts given to us by the medical materialists. We must neither work too hard nor sit too long. With the former comes calluses of the mind and body. With the latter comes sleep and fatalism. With excessive preoccupation with the works of others, or with scholastic success, comes an intellectual conceit that is a web as effective as a concrete wall, and with such also comes the confusion of words. On the other hand, abstinence from books and teachers results in a lack of source material that might save us years and health. We cannot do it all with our intuition alone. We must know ourselves in order to find the obstacles that find their roots within us. Too often our decisions are influenced by emotions. When this happens, we will pick a teacher for his personality and pick a system that harmonizes with our appetites. Another obstacle within us is fatigue. The mind goes to sleep after so many hours on a subject. The mind retreats from problems that hold no hope of immediate solution. Our attention goes tumbling off, accelerated by desires and rationalization. Some physical and mental obstacles can be surmounted by observing and correcting chemical conditions and glandular secretions. When we take into account the enormous amount of and weight of factors that influence our thinking and hence affect any spiritual drive, we are apt to throw our hands up in despair. We might in fact decide to throw the entire world's library into the flames, presuming that everything could be discounted by virtue of possible chicanery of the authors or by virtue of our own susceptibility to hypnosis, manias, and body chemistry. The coffins of Poe, Coleridge, and Oscar Wilde may contain nothing but empty dope capsules and alcohol bottles, but their writings give me the feeling that they experienced something that the ordinary normal citizen does not find. Their occupation had its hazards. Naturally, the experience of permanent physical disease is not desirable in that it is surely not necessary for spiritual enlightenment. We find that alcohol can immediately change the conviction of the user. And the same is true about the user of narcotics. When the great thirst is upon him, he will be vindictive and full of praise for the grape. When the thirst is softened by a few drinks, he develops a second personality, which may be the dramatization of a personality that he wishes to possess. The hangover stage introduces the third personality, in which physical conditions render the alcoholic despondent and remorseful. He now hates the grape and himself for the alliance. Strangely enough, out of all this conflict of attitudes has occasionally emerged men of great spiritual stature. I would not advise anyone to take the alcoholic path in order to find spiritual amazement, for the simple reason that the gods seem to desert alcoholics in great numbers. The percentage of alcoholics that free themselves from the depths of addiction is very small in comparison to the number of alcoholics that die in the addiction or commit suicide. Oblique dogmatic systems. Various authors and systems whose works fall short of being valuable in relation to the pursuit of truth are generally not aware of their particular tangential direction, which removed them from the functional position which they covet. These sources digress along recognizable lines and can be identified by their chief feature or style. They're all, first of all, the utilitarians, of which we have heard. To them, religion has a value if it serves as a social lubricant, if it heals, if it aids in the business ventures, or if it comforts the troubled. Healing itself may often be recognized as a vain implement for the healer's glory or monetary gain, in exchange for a health gift to those who do not even seem to be grateful. If, as some believe, the energy for healing actually comes from the combined energies of the minister and the congregation, then healing may well be a prostitution of valuable energy on a lost cause, or upon a person who will, in turn, only spend it again with poor spiritual thirst. To To this group, utilitarians, we must consign the Pollyanna of unity, which labels its periodical better business. To it also, we must consign almost every organized religion that boasts of its value to society by keeping its members in line, and those which seek survival and acceptance by virtue of their social usefulness. A second category of thinkers are the pseudo-practical critics. They are the scientists who have momentarily invaded the field of transcendentalism, or are the various tumid reporters who exude the attitude that they are able to look at all the things objectively. They tackle every concept with a sort of conservative attitude. They might excuse ESP or other phenomena as not being illogical, but they would be careful not to associate their own beliefs with the issue, and they employ a detached literary style to give the impression that they are a popular and irrefutable medium of common sense. They who manifest this attitude are the literacy barristers who would rather settle out of court than admit a position that would require a vigorous defense. They are not barristers of hope or principle, but men of glory and a show of intellectual cleverness. They go into the court of human reason half-heartedly and are very careful not to establish a position that might indicate that their own thinking is on trial. They are careful not to endorse anything that might at a later date undergo a qualifying change. If they endorse the field of mysticism, they will do so timidly. A third category of pseudo-authorities are the piddlers. These treat mysticism as a hobby or as an excuse for social gatherings. They are often part-time mystics or are those who indulge in the solemn-faced mummery of lodge work. A few will be extremely well-read in many different philosophies, but will treat the whole field with little more respect than they would bestow on fiction. They may become engrossed in a cult or ism whose main substance is the endless juggling of symbols with questionable results. They may become so engrossed in the juggling that the pleasure of juggling becomes an intellectual titillation and conceit rather than a potential means of finding truth. And yet the juggling of symbols under control may well bring us results in the scientific field and in the sharpening of the faculties that aid in direct experience. Thus we have astrologers who only tell fortunes, and numerologists who would predict our political or amorous compatibilities. These are the augurs who examine the flights of birds and the entrails in the slaughterhouse for a hint from heaven. They are the strangely inspired who allow superstition to overbalance reason and intuition. They will write books filled with symbols and invocations that do not work. They will compound secret codes that will consume years of the reader's time before their meaninglessness is exposed. To compound the mystery, these authors will assume pseudonyms or may even remain anonymous. The concept mechanics are piddlers of a more complicated type. They build new concepts by borrowing choice tidbits from the old ones. They observe the dying of current religions and fancy themselves to be phoenixes that will sprout from the ashes of the dying religions. Their inability to supplant current religions or theories lies in their inability to think with their intuition or to realize that another, the reader, might penetrate their processes and reject such concept building. For the former are fabricators, not believers. They speak with cleverness rather than sincerity, and they are rewarded with our admission of their cleverness and little more. They note the discrepancies of other concepts and their limitations. Then they go about dreaming up a celestial science that will answer all of our hopes and desires and will explain some previously unexplained phenomena. The writings of concept mechanics are generally very complex, but in the last analysis are no more than presumptive formulae and utopian air castles. Their concepts are built upon accepted axioms, which we are more eager to accept than to deny. Yet the numerous cosmo-conceptions that result from the same set of axioms bring the student to much bewilderment and leave him wishing he had examined the foundations first. Instances of concept building may be found in most Rosicrucian literature, in some theosophical literature, and in most cult literature that borrows from or pretends to borrow from Hinduism, Eleusinian lore, Essene wisdom, the Kabbalah, from any ancient religious writings, or from combinations of any of these sects. Readers of such concept structures are often, besides being misled, titillated by suspense, and come to expect that the truth will come on the next page. The actual subscriber will hold his breath waiting for a master or for initiation. Steiner writes profusely describing a way of self-development which he admits is all meaningless unless we are initiated. Yet there is a discreet silence about the nature of initiation, so that which might bring some element of verification to his writings hangs like a golden plum always beyond our grasp. Tantalizing becomes the chief feature of the cult vendor. Another category is that of the quoters. Here are the writers who shrink from standing alone, even as the critics do. In their writings, they seem to be trying to tell their message indirectly. Some will use only occasional referential quotations, but others may compile entire books of copied material. Such is the style of Aldous Huxley's Doors to Perception. There is a subtle cleverness in this attempt to inspire conviction by summoning another's ghost and forcing that ghost to testify for your cause while inhibiting and limiting the testimony so that only those are taken out of the text that will flatter the quoter. The thundering fundamentalist is an example. Occasionally, the sacred books of the East are quoted, and then often in an apologetic manner. The chief feature of the quoter is his manifest cowardice and inability to outline in his own words that which he believes. His main tool is the inference that backing by important people makes for the truth. The gimmick users are a very subtle group. These have discovered that which a scientist would call a law, and they gain either fame or following by either demonstrating the law or by extolling it with more significance than it deserves. Thus, some are unselfish and develop the knowledge of the law to the betterment of mankind, but some become so enthralled with their discovery that they do not bother to progress further themselves to the discovery of more laws or to self-improvement in general. There has existed in occult writings for centuries the explanation of the law that governs healing. It is not the sole property of Christians. The Mohammedans recently challenged Billy Graham to a healing contest, which he politely rejected. This supposedly happened on his tour of Africa. Mr. Graham may not even profess to be a healer, but if he were, he would have difficulty in a Muslim country or in an era where people strongly disbelieve in Christ. The amazing thing about some healers is that they do not even understand the law, but use it instinctively. Another of these gimmicks is the law of love. It has been found that love begets love and hate begets hate, and that hate destroys the hater. Love may also be self-destructive if we do not know which types of love are to be inhibited. Somerset Maugham hints that Christ may have been destroyed because of his unqualified love. That was in Razor's Edge. As a result of the knowledge of the ultimate value of love, quite a few isms have incorporated themselves around that law, forgetting all other endeavors. Ramakrishna was supposed to have attained a deep spiritual position because of intense love for Kali. Some Christian mystics have employed the same process to achieve rapture. Another gimmick is positive thinking. There could be no denying the power of positive thinking, but we can really run into error if we do not know its limitations. Partisans who try to gauge their lives by the Norman Vincent Peale's handbook find that they still clash with society and other obstacles. Positive thinking can mean only conventional thinking and is limited as to effectiveness regardless of the nobility of purpose. if that purpose is not popular. Mary Baker Eddy discovered the illusory nature of the material world. However, things get complicated when a person attempts to heal the illusory body of the illusory disease. It would seem that the real project would be to first find reality. Centuries ago, theologians discovered another law, but they continued to misunderstand and misuse it. This is the law of proportional returns, or that which the Indians might call karma. We borrow from physics and state that any object being struck manages to affect the striking object with the same force. That which you sow, you will reap. Hate begets hate, and if you hurl negative thoughts, you will in turn be visited by others with negative attitudes. All of these things seem possible, but to affix to this law the idea of personal guilt may be the needless weaving of a whip for the already belabored mind of man. There is a considerable amount of friction over the ideas of guilt or degrees of guilt. The fact that there are two schools of thought on will, determinism and libertarianism, which means that man cannot quite make up his mind whether he should accept guilt or not. The proponents of guilt claim that guilt is the sense of responsibility that man must accept if he, man, wishes to have any right to function as an individual in charge of his own destiny. Thus, we have sin cataloged and categorized. We have analysts who have examined sin qualitatively and quantitatively and proceeded from there to prescribe to the gram and grain how much pain or money must be paid to take the vigor out of the inevitable repercussion. Thus, also in India, we have much confusion among believers in karma. Some Hindus breathe with apprehension lest a microscopic retaliator get caught in their intake. The oversimplifiers. These are not to be confused with men who honestly try to avoid complexity and verbosity. We get the idea from the oversimplifiers that the mystic and the transcendentalist take themselves too seriously. The former would have us believe that there is a very simple explanation for all phenomena. They would say that a man did not see an apparition, he merely thought he saw one. And the man who was healed, to judge by them, was not sick in the first place. Precognition to them is coincidence. The man who performed a miracle simply hypnotized his audience. Spirit manifestations are merely mental extrusions, etc. Now, the oversimplifiers may be nearly right in some instances, even though they are looking for an easy explanation. They are not idiots, but they are uninspired, even though they sense that others tend to confuse inspiration with superstition. Their chief error comes from being unacquainted with the field which they criticize. To criticize a mystic, one has to be a mystic. One cannot view mysticism objectively and do it justice. The tired thinker is apt to rationalize with oversimplification. From his inability or fatigue comes a weird sort of bravery. After prolonged contemplation about life after death, he will announce that since there is nothing that can be done about death, it is foolish to give death a second thought. Eat, drink, and be merry. Let me summarize a bit on the above categories. We cannot speak without quoting to some degree. We cannot simplify without running the risk of oversimplification. We may all be unconscious concept mechanics, since we may be so impelled by our gestalts, and we are all piddlers when it comes to our attitude toward the absolute. There is not so much damage in erratic thinking as there is in the conscious employment of erratic thinking and techniques of writing that might promote confusion. And all criticism is designed to save time for the seeker.